Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Morrow. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Debu Tripathi, MD, a professor and chairman in the Department of Breast Medical Oncology in the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, as well as a co-chair of the 41st Annual Miami Breast Cancer Conference, about the unique components of the meeting that make it worth returning to year after year. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Tripathi discussed aspects that stood out to him during his first time speaking at Miami Breast, ways that the meeting has evolved over the years, and the types of valuable multidisciplinary discussions that the conference inspires. This year's conference will also be the very last time that Dr. Tripathi will serve as co-chair. The 41st Annual Miami Breast Cancer Conference will take place March 7th through 10th, 2024 at the Fontainebleau Miami Beach in Florida. Registration is now open.
Let's think back to your very first time, if you can remember, attending Miami Breast Cancer Conference. What was that like? How did it make you feel? And really, what made you want to then dive in and get even more involved with it as a co-chair?
Well, the first time I was invited to speak at the Miami Breast Cancer Conference, I didn't know much about the history of the conference. So I walk into the room to give my presentation. And, you know, by then I had already been experienced and comfortable with giving lectures and picking my content. And we were doing some really interesting research, so I was excited to present it. But when I walked into that cavernous hall at the Lowe's Hotel, I felt this energy that I had not seen before in a meeting, because the meeting really has an aura about it where not only the speakers, but the attendees just have this amazing attention. They're focused on what you're doing and what you're saying. Every word you're saying matters. And it instantly hit me that everybody's here to learn. They're here to take it to a higher level, and they already know a lot. So you better do a good job. That's the environment that I like. I thrive in it. I like to work with people that know a lot about what's going on in breast cancer and then bring it to a new level based on what we're doing, what we're thinking, and also to field questions, because I learn a lot from the questions I get asked. What I learned is that it's a very interactive meeting with high-powered people that have a diversity of opinions, because it's multidisciplinary. You have surgeons who are asking me questions about molecular biology, or you have behavioral scientists that are very interested in the patient experience. So it becomes a very multidimensional type of meeting where no matter what you're presenting, you're going to be asked questions from many different directions and many different fields. It's your chance to not only talk about what you want to talk about, but also get input from other people and maybe talk about something you necessarily don't want to talk about, or a pressure point. Why didn't this work? Or you're challenged with an answer that you really, or a question that you don't really have the answer to, but it's a good opportunity to express why we don't have an answer and what we need to do to get an answer. So all of those qualities that make this meeting special came to me in a rush at that first encounter. And then I was fortunate enough to get asked again. I said, well, I don't know if I'm going to get asked again. I know that Dr. Osman used to rotate his faculty every other year or something, but some didn't get asked back. And when I got asked back 2 years later on cycle, I was really glad to be a part of it. And since then, I've been coming back regularly and getting an inner look at how the meeting operates and how we make it really appealing to not only the high-powered scientists, but also the clinicians that are seeing patients every day. It's a really unique experience.
How have you actually seen this conference evolve in your time as co-chair?
Well, the meeting has always been about how am I going to treat the next patient I see? Very clinically oriented, very practical, very utilitarian. However, it's utilitarian on a high level. I want to know the science behind it. I want to know why that's the right thing to do. So that's really what the magic is about that meeting, is you understand it not only because this is how we do it, but why it is and what the data behind it is and how we might make it even better.
In all of your time doing this, do you have maybe like one particular moment that really stands out to you, something that made you feel really proud to be a part of it?
Yes, I do. Probably one of the most exciting moments was when we got to present some of our work with HER2 targeting therapy, because it's a field that really crossed disciplines. And so presenting neoadjuvant therapy using biological agents is something that surgeons wouldn't have dreamed of before, that you're actually going to treat a patient who's ready to go to surgery. They have operable breast cancer, and you're actually going to treat them with medical treatment first. And to show the data that we were seeing with treating HER2 positive cancers, which are very responsive to treatment, and seeing it sometimes disappear, melt away when patients would go to surgery, there was no tumor left. The notion that we could do that with such a high frequency, and also the fact that these patients actually do better and have a lower chance of recurrence, but are also able to undergo a less surgery and more conservative surgery. That was a moment that really stuck with me. And it wasn't just me alone. There were other presentations because there were many studies going on during this time. So it was really a sea change. And the very gratifying part of all of this was that the surgeons who were listening were really enthusiastic about it. They said, you know, this is great. We can work with our medical oncology colleagues and be able to offer less surgery and really do it as a teamwork and coordinate it and be able to see these patients ahead of time before they get treated and then see them during their treatment and actually watch it happen. So it brought us together as disciplines a little bit more. We'd always been working together, seeing our patients in multidisciplinary tumor boards, but this just took it to another level.
I remember the Miami Breast Cancer Conference I attended and the atezolizumab in triple negative approval came through like right in the middle of the conference. The excitement at the Fontainebleau was, you could just feel it everywhere in those hallways and around the ballroom. And it really, I think some people had to change their presentations on the fly because of the news coming out. That was really exciting too.
Yes, it was amazing. Atezolizumab got approved right then and there while we were there and the data was being shown. It just gave everybody a sense of how quickly things were happening.
I'm sure you've probably seen your fair share of a lot of patient cases of colleagues kind of talking with one another or being able to, you know, maybe meet an expert in a patient's disease that, you know, their physician had all these questions and didn't know how to best treat them. And then they go to the conference and they come across with somebody who specializes in that area. And have you seen any kinds of like those kind of clinical conversations, solutions to some of these challenges coming up and, you know, being addressed and being able to, you know, try and transform some of these patients' treatment plans?
Yes, this happens a lot because we have paradigms and rules that we follow. This treatment works better than that, so this is what we recommend. But the art of practicing medicine is the exceptional cases, the cases that aren't straightforward. This doesn't fit into box A. It doesn't fit into box B. How do we deal with this situation? Those are the ones that are most valuable, I think. And sometimes our audience may ask a question and get two different answers, two different faculty members. And it illustrates the fact that there isn't a right answer, but there's a way to think it through. And sometimes thinking it through involves the patient's point of view. Well, you have two options here. It depends on whether the patient is willing to take treatment that's going to take X amount of time or be subject to this potential side effect or long-term toxicity. Or it depends on a test that maybe the physician that was asking the question didn't know about. Well, you can send this molecular analysis that might help you. Yeah, so there have been times when the person asking the question actually thought it through and came up with their own answer. And then there are other times when they recognize that maybe there isn't a right answer. And these are generally pretty well accomplished clinicians that are asking you these questions. So there's got to be something complicated about that case. But when they think it through and they take the patient's point of view or maybe listen to some new data that's come out that helps them make a decision, they feel very empowered. And the sense I get from many of the audience members is that they feel really happy for the patient, that they're going to be able to go back and say, look, I talked to my colleagues and this is what we came up with. The patient feels very privileged that This doctor went to this meeting, took their case, discussed it with a faculty member. And we feel good about having been a part of that too, because all of us are in that situation ourselves, trying to get an answer and knowing that the patient wants to hear something that's going to give them the confidence to move forward. It's good all around and very gratifying.
What will you do now for the 2025 conference? Do you still plan to come as an attendee, or are you taking a little bit of a hiatus? What are your plans away from being co-chair?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure I'll still want to come. But what I've recognized for a long time is we've got so many wonderful young faculty that are coming up. And we've got people now that I have known since they were assistant professors are now full professors, chairman of their departments. And I'm realizing these are the people that need to be up on the podium and talking, a fresh new group of people. And we have so many committee members that are ready to be elevated to co-chairs and ultimately a chair. So it's a natural progression, and it feels good. It feels like I've done my time here. I'm ready to sort of sit back and do as I may. If I get invited to come and speak and I can make it, sure, I'll come. If I can come as an attendee and just actually watch, that's fine as well. What's most important is we're going to get young, talented people taking over, and I'm sure they're going to change it and take it in different directions, which is how a meeting should do it. You don't want it to be static. You want it to be fresh. You want it to be moving. You want it to continue to evolve.
What are you excited about this year's meeting? Any kind of recent data or changes to the breast cancer paradigm that you're really excited to discuss with this year's attendees?
Yeah, there's several things that are really cutting edge and I think are going to be changing things. We have new biological therapies that have been recently been approved that are mutation specific. So you actually have to sequence the genome, you find a mutation, and you use a targeted drug. So we've had the approval of drugs like elacestrant about a year ago, capivasertib, an AKT inhibitor just 2 or 3 months ago. We are going to be talking about how to apply those drugs, how to test for them, what are the genomic aberrations that would lend themselves to being treated with this drug. There's another interesting field that has been brought to the forefront now, and this is the notion that we can detect DNA in the blood. And of course, we've known for years that we can detect tumor DNA in the blood, and we can actually sequence that DNA and get results without having to do biopsies. But now these tests have gotten very, very sensitive. We can actually pick up small amounts of tumor DNA from a patient who had cancer and is now free of cancer, but maybe in the process of recurring. And now we can see their tumor DNA. And we already know that when we can measure it with some of these very sensitive techniques, that it does increase the risk that they are going to have a true recurrence in the near future. And now we're trying to see if we can do something about it. Can we treat patients and prevent that recurrence in the first place? So this is an exciting area, but it also is an area that brings up a lot of controversies. For example, for patients participating in these studies, we take a blood sample. They may not know exactly what they're getting into. And so we feel that we have to inform them as best we can that, yes, this is a blood test that may give us an answer that we don't know what to do with, because we really don't know what to do when someone has tumor DNA. The first thing we would do, obviously, is get a scan and see if there's actually something we can see. But many times you can't see it because it's microscopic. It's just below the threshold of any imaging. And we don't know how to treat it. Yet now the patient has this information, which is certainly a stressor. And this is sort of an ethical issue. Should we do studies that will put patients in this difficult situation? How can we inform them ahead of time? We always go through an informed consent process with clinical trials, but this one is a little bit different. There's that aspect of it. But then again, there's the aspirational aspect that we might be able to prevent recurrences in the first place if we can catch them at the very beginning and we have drugs that can work against them. Especially targeted drugs, things like immunotherapy or mutation-specific drugs that might pertain to their tumor. So that's another exciting area. And then the third thing I'll say that's really exciting that has gotten better and better every year is our tumor board. We have our tumor board on Thursday. We present complicated cases with our panel of experts. We take cases from the audience, and it is really helpful. I learn a lot. Our audience learns a lot. Our speakers learn a lot. And we're treating them or making treatment decisions based on the state of the art and the newest knowledge that we have. We actually have one session that's called the molecular tumor board that actually deals with the genomic aberrations that we detect in patients' tumors and how do we manage those. So it reflects where the world is in the year 2024, where we've come a long way. The Miami Breast Cancer Conference has been transformative. Everybody should experience it.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.